This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Columbia River Crossing. And so our guest today is Joe Courtwright, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's the chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and the president of Impressa, a consulting firm here in Portland. So, Joe Courtwright, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Paris. Good to be here.
Well, you wrote a very interesting article. It was in the Oregonian a couple weeks ago, all about the Columbia River Crossing. And I guess, where should we start? Just start with the total cost? Is $3.4 billion they're going to spend on this thing?
Well, $3.4 billion is the price tag. The total cost is going to be a lot higher for a variety of reasons. That doesn't include the operating and maintenance cost, and it's proposed to be constructed as a toll bridge, so that means that we'll pay tolls and the cost of collecting those tolls for an indefinite period of time, as well as the interest on billions of dollars that they'll borrow. So the total cost is some multiple of that price tag. And the other thing I'd say is the evidence of these large highway construction projects, these so-called mega projects, is they almost always come in over budget. And for billion-dollar bridge projects around the world, the average cost overrun is something on the order of 30%, which in the case of this project would be another $1 billion to the price tag.
Wow. So over four $4 billion then.
In all likelihood, yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. And the Oregon legislature voted they approved a $450 million contribution to this.
Well, what they did is they authorized some borrowing.
Uh-huh.
There's no additional revenue, so what they're saying is we would take money that would otherwise be available for construction projects or road repair in Oregon and use it to pay back bonds that will be issued. And there's, I think, a bit of a misrepresentation with the bill. It says $450 million, but it also authorizes the Oregon Department of Transportation to issue essentially an unlimited amount of bonds that are backed by tolls and federal revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the concerns a lot of us have, is this is sort of just an effort to do anything to get the project started, and then we'll see the price tag escalate over time.
Well, I think there's sort of two issues right there. One is that, which I don't know if we should just talk about it that much this show, but I've talked about in the past, is that if we had a state bank, we could float our own bonds. You wouldn't have to pay a lot of interest going to commercial banks. Is that true? I mean, would that happen?
Well, it depends on what the borrowing cost of a state bank would be. The borrowing cost, actually, the proposal currently is to borrow a chunk of this money from the federal government through a special program that they have. So the borrowing costs are, for this, surprisingly low. But that to me is a bit of an illusion, because again, you're spending it on an asset that is of very dubious value. So regardless of how cheap the money is, it's a poor investment.
The other issue would be, does this make less money available for other highway projects in the state?
There's no question about that. The legislature, when it approved what's called House Bill 2800, what they did was just essentially authorized the Oregon Department of Transportation to go more deeply into debt for this project. And that money will have to be repaid somehow. It will be repaid by taking money out of the state highway fund from gas tax monies and or from federal grants. And those are the monies that we count on year in and year out to maintain the road system in Oregon. So it clearly does reduce the amount of money that's available for other projects around the state for the next 30 years.
And I would think there's lots of road projects that are more necessary than this thing.
Well, it's not at all clear that we have even enough money in the highway fund to simply take care of, to maintain the road system that we currently have.
Uh-huh.
With driving going down, and driving is down about 7% statewide and nationwide over the last 5 years or so, gas tax revenues are going down, and as a result, the whole viability of the transportation finance system is in jeopardy, which is exactly the wrong time to go and essentially borrow a big chunk of money against future revenues.
Well, here we get into some of the other things you mentioned in your article. The case for this bridge is based on some very dubious, rosy assumptions. And one of them, well, let's get to that one first. The one that really interests me the most is these outdated projections. Like, do they really project gasoline at $1 a gallon?
Well, the project is based on the need for and the financing of the project is based on some traffic projections. The traffic projections were done based on 2005 base data, so they're about 7 or 8 years old now. And the models that were used to construct them were calibrated using data from the 1990s, when gasoline cost $1 or $1.25 a gallon. And so the models that they've used are essentially incorporating assumptions about very cheap energy and project very rapid and essentially unending growth in the amount of driving. So right now, about 128,000 cars a day go back and forth across the I-5 bridges. And they're predicting that, they were predicting that would go to about 180,000 cars a day. And in fact, since they made their forecast in 2005, traffic on the bridges has been flat or declining. So it's, you know, the need for this, the project, is based on a world that we know no longer exists, an era of very cheap energy.
Well, can these projections be corrected, or are we stuck with them?
Well, you know, from the standpoint of justifying the project and saying what terrible things will happen if we don't build this bridge, and they have these dire forecasts of gridlock, which are just erroneous because the forecast is wrong, they've started doing some new and more realistic forecasts to justify the financing, because nobody is going to lend them money based on these clearly erroneous forecasts. And what they did, and this was released actually last week after the editorial I wrote, they released a new set of forecasts that said, after we start tolling the bridges, and there'll be about a peak hour toll of about $3.50 if you buy a transponder, and about $5 if you don't, and for each car crossing over the bridge. Once you do that, then somewhere between 40 and 60% of the people who are currently crossing the bridge will stop using it. So we'll go from about 128,000 vehicles per day to something on the order of 50 to 75,000 vehicles per day, which ironically will mean that once you toll that bridge, you'll suddenly discover that you have more than enough capacity with the existing three lanes in each direction.
Well, that's amazing. Kind of like a catch-22 there or something.
Yeah.
Did you say that if you have a transponder that you pay a $3 toll, and if you don't, you pay a $5 toll? Is that true?
$3.50 and $5, yeah. And so what they'll do is they'll set up what's called barrier-free tolling. So they'll take photographs of every car that crosses the bridge, and people who have transponders, their payment will be made automatically and electronically, and people who don't have transponders will have their license plate photographed, and they'll be sent a bill via mail, and there'll be a surcharge on that bill of about $1.50. So if you have the transponder, you pay a $3.50 toll. If you don't, you'll pay about a $5 toll.
Wow. That's something I hadn't heard about. So if you're a tourist, or if you just use a bridge very occasionally, you're paying $5. Can you pay with real money, or do you have to do
the idea behind modern tolling is that we want to make it as automated and have as little labor involved as possible. So what you'll do is if you don't buy a transponder, you can pay online. You can pay by mail, but it won't be the toll booth and cash in a basket type of arrangement that you may have seen elsewhere.
Well, you know, I've studied, you know, we call a peak oil, I guess it might be more correct to call a peak cheap oil. And I've studied that a lot. It just seems to me pretty clear that oil is going to, and gasoline is going to get more and more expensive, and that there's going to be much less automobile traffic or truck traffic. Be more rail traffic, and goods will be shipped by river where it's available. And it seems like a no-brainer.
Well, yeah. Again, this is the project that is. The underlying assumptions we know are simply wrong.
Uh-huh.
The idea that traffic is going to grow steadily as if gasoline costs $1 or $1.25 a gallon is just, it's simply wrong. And to squander several billion dollars of a very dear public sector capital on supporting a project that is tied to, you know, a fiction, is a really a sad mistake.
So like we're mortgaging our futures to pay for yesterday's project or something like that.
Exactly.
Well, you also mentioned that another one of these assumptions is that we are counting on $400 million from the federal government, and that is in question.
Yeah, the way this project has always been described is that Congress would be so enamored of moving traffic on Interstate 5 that they would contribute $400 million in the form of an earmark, additional money to Oregon,
mm-hmm.
Over and above what we would otherwise get. And it's very clear Congress passed a new transportation bill last summer, and they had no earmarks for anything in it, much less the $400 million that they're hoping for, which really means that any of the federal highway money that gets spent on this project will be money that gets taken away from the pots of money that would otherwise fund other projects around the state.
And then there's the Congress is sort of slashing right and left anyway. And also, we are counting on the feds to pay for 100% of light rail, which they probably won't do.
Yeah, typically the federal government pays for about half the cost of light rail. That's what they did in the case of the Portland-Milwaukee light rail line that's under construction now.
Mm-hmm.
The project proponents think that they'll be able to take advantage of a special provision in law that allows the federal government to contribute a higher amount, but that provision is untested, and as you noted, the federal government is cutting back the amount of money in a variety of programs, and the sequester, which went into effect last week, is taking about $100 million a year out of the Federal Transit Administration, which is what would have to contribute to this.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and my guest is Joe Courtwright, who's a chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, the president of the Impresa consulting firm, and he's written a very interesting article about the Columbia River crossing, which is kind of where peak oil, where the rubber meets the road right here in Portland. So it seems to me that if these assumptions don't turn out, then the state of Oregon is, we might be stuck for a lot more than just $450 million.
Yeah, it's a high likelihood that if this project were to go forward, that the state would issue probably more than $1 billion in debt, and that debt would have to be repaid, in the last case, by Oregon taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
So they're assuming that they'll get federal money. They're assuming that they'll get a lot of toll revenue. If either of those sources fall short, and or if the price of the project goes up, then Oregon taxpayers have to make up the difference.
Which may be $1 billion, even though they say it's a $450 million obligation that when you take the interest into account, it's and these overruns or whatever, it could be $1 billion.
Yeah, if you were buying a car or a house, they would have to disclose the interest costs and the other payments that you would be liable for, and that's one of the things that really hasn't been done with this project.
Well, this is a little bit of a side issue. I've talked about this before in other shows. Are you familiar with Ellen Brown, who writes about the state banks and the one in North Dakota? And one of the things she says is that, if we had a state bank, we could float these bond measures and the interest would stay right here in Oregon. It wouldn't go to commercial banks. Is that a viable proposition?
I'm not sure that that makes any difference to this project. Again, you'd have to take money out of Oregon taxpayers' hands, and it would be a real cost to Oregonians, regardless of who we borrow the money from.
Well, now, when the legislature passed this thing, I'm really disappointed. You know, it's like I got my two legislators are really good people, and they are both Democrats, liberal Democrats, but they voted for this thing. And it's like their cop-out is that there are all these triggers that if they don't happen, then the project does not go forward. And you say that these triggers may not work. They may not stop anything. And one of them is the bill only requires an application for federal funding. In other words, if the state of Oregon applies for funding, that is a trigger right there. Just the application.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, it's worded a little bit differently. Uh-huh. It's if the Federal Transit Administration submits the application to Congress. But you're right. The gold standard would be the federal government signs a contract that commits it to spending the amount of money, but that's not the trigger. And the other triggers are similarly worded in a way that they, at least superficially, sound reassuring. But when you read the fine print closely, it doesn't really obligate other people to come up with the money. So, for example, there's a trigger that relates to Washington's contributing funding, but there's no specified dollar amount that Washington has to contribute. So I have some real concerns about the triggers themselves. The other thing that I would add to that is, and this project's been going along for about 5 or 6 years now, other bodies, the City of Portland and Metro, both attached or tried to attach conditions to their approval, their planning approval of the project several years ago. And like clockwork, the project came back a year or two later and said, boy, we really tried to meet those conditions, but we couldn't. Are you going to stand in the way of our big project here? And so while there are good reasons to doubt the detail of these triggers, the history of this project is that the project will promise anything to anybody to get a yes vote and then come back and change the deal later to keep things going.
Well, I know in your article you mentioned Robert Moses did this way back when. He was a very powerful man in New York State where I grew up, and one of his legacies was Jones Beach, where you can take a bus to get to Jones Beach, but you can only go to the main beach. You cannot go to the eight or so side beaches because the underpasses or the overpasses are too low to allow buses to go underneath them. And the whole idea was Robert Moses did not want New York City riffraff coming to his Jones Beach.
Yeah, there's a famous book by Robert Caro, The Power Broker, which lays out a lot of the very clever strategies that Robert Moses uses. And I have always thought of it as a cautionary tale, but the folks at the CRC have been using it as a how-to manual.
Wow. Well, you know, he actually came to Portland back in the 40s.
Yes, he did. He spent a couple of days at the Portland Hotel sketching out a whole grid of freeways, including the Mount Hood Freeway, which we wisely decided not to build.
And I think he wanted to tear down Union Station.
I don't remember that, but wouldn't surprise me.
Replace it with some huge monstrosity of a transportation center and all these freeways would converge and everything. Well, so here we are. I mean, it's like you were talking about the Washington contribution to this. How much is that in doubt? I just read an article, I think it was yesterday, about Republican woman legislator from Ridgefield, who I guess is very powerful up there, who is dead set against this crossing.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of opposition on the Washington side, in Clark County in particular. Most of the Republicans, if not all of the Republicans in Washington County, are opposed to the project. Not that they necessarily share the same viewpoint as a lot of the critics on this side. They're they're concerned about the light rail piece, and also I think about the tolling piece. But there is a lot of opposition in Washington.
Do you think it'll carry the day there? I mean, if Washington doesn't approve it at all, I guess the thing is dead then, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, there are several approvals that have to happen in Washington State. The legislature or somebody in state government would need to come up with a state's share of the money. And in addition, Washington law requires that the folks in Clark County vote to approve a plan for high-capacity transit before they can build light rail. And that hasn't happened yet, so I think that's one of the other major obstacles.
Well, how does that work? What is high capacity transit?
Well, it's a term used in Washington law. It basically means if they're going to build light rail or what's called a bus rapid transit, they have to get the voters to approve that in Clark County before they can build that system under Washington law.
Well, they seem very skittish about light rail altogether up there.
Yeah, they are. There's no question that they are.
Well, is there any prospect of lawsuits derailing this thing?
Yeah, there are a couple of legal challenges to the project. One is there are a couple of suits that have been filed against the environmental impact statement, which, in my view, is manifestly. Manifestly fails to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. There are a whole bunch of things. The project that they're proposing to build now is not the same project that was contained in the environmental impact statement that they put out several years ago. They make huge changes to it. They're probably not even going to build all of it. They've failed to disclose a lot of impacts. They're changing the height of the bridge from what it was before, which has some dramatic impacts on traffic, mm-hmm. as well as the visual impacts of the bridge itself. So there's that lawsuit. There's this lawsuit that raises endangered species issues. And there's also going to be probably legal action around the permit that the U.S. Coast Guard has to issue to allow the bridge to be built over the navigable waterway.
Yeah, well, those got a lot of attention, the Coast Guard issue, and also the fact that I guess there are three kind of factories on the upstream side of the bridge, and they couldn't get their goods barged under that bridge if it's built.
Yeah, there are three big marine contractors there, Oregon Iron Works, Greenberry, and Thompson Metal Fab, that all move very large structures underneath the bridge, ironically including pieces of other bridges, and they have said they would be put out of business if the bridge is built to the 116-foot clearance that the departments of transportation are proposing.
So where are we now? To kind of sum up, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, obvious difficulties. Well, the whole idea of the bridge is an outmoded concept, and it's based on all these rosy assumptions. So where are we right now? The legislature has passed this commitment, and I guess Governor Kitzhaber will sign on to it. And then, so what happens after that?
Well, there's still a lot of steps to go in this process. There is that Coast Guard bridge permit. There's this litigation. Washington has to approve its share. And then the Federal Transit Administration has to approve its funding as well. So there are many, many steps in this process yet.
Do you think that will happen? I mean, there's obviously a lot of pressure behind this thing. It seems to have really steamrolled our Democrats here in Oregon. And the woman in Ridgefield, I don't recall her name, but
Senator Ann Rivers.
That's right. And she's expecting a lot of pressure, and she says she's not going to cave in on this. Do you think, you know, these interests will prevail in Washington, or just sort of political judgment, I guess? But
yeah, I'm hesitant to make political judgment, but I've always thought that this project is so expensive and so unwise that it won't happen. And I still don't think it will ever happen, at least not in the form that it's been presented.
What other form do you think it could take? Is there any way that they could salvage and make it a reasonable thing to do?
I think the current proposal is fundamentally flawed. Mm-hmm. The best way to describe the project is it's a 5 mile long freeway that just happens to cross a river, and that solution is a solution to a problem that we don't have. There are some issues. There are some traffic congestion issues. There are some questions about the seismic integrity of the bridge. But those can be dealt with in a much more cost-effective manner by essentially keeping this asset that the Oregon Department of Transportation says has at least another 50 or 60 years of life in it.
That's the present bridge.
The present bridge. Mm-hmm. They also did studies that showed that you could bring the bridge up to modern seismic standards for about the same cost as demolishing it. So you could keep that existing structure. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other things we could do to relieve traffic. We could build an arterial bridge that connects Hayden Island with Portland and Vancouver so that the people who are on Hayden Island or who are traveling there don't have to get on the highway system, the freeway system, in order to make those journeys. That would relieve a lot of the congestion. There are a bunch of things that you could do immediately without spending, multiple billion dollars that would make congestion much less. There's been no attempt to try any of those things. So there are a lot of cheaper, faster, greener ways to deal with these problems than a 5 mile long freeway.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. We've been talking to Joe Courtwright, who is the chair of the Governor's Council on Economic Advisors. I guess he's not taking your advice.
Well, it's the Council of Economic Advisors, not the Council of Economic Dictators. So we give advice, and he's free to take it or not.
And you're president of Impress, that's a consulting firm here in Portland.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. We're going to stay on top of this issue, and it's because it's sort of where the local and the global come together. So thank you very much, Joe Courtwright.
Great talk to you, Per.
This has been Fight the Empire. Stay tuned for what's coming up. I believe Air Cascadia is next on KBOO, your radio station.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. And unfortunately, Air Cascadia will not be airing this morning. Instead, we've got an hour's worth of flashpoints coming up in just a little bit. Don't forget, at 11, Oregon writer Barbara Corrado Pope will be talking about her latest mystery, The Missing Italian Girl, The Lives of Women in 19th Century France, and her own life as a women's studies pioneer. And at 11:30, the hosts of Black Book Talk speak with Cheryl Waiters, author of the memoir Blood, Sweat, and High Heels, about her struggles as an African-American female working to overcome gender and racial biases in the male-dominated field of construction. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support and community radio station, your support to community radio station, KBOO. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Once again, Air Cascadia not airing this morning, so instead we've got an hour-long edition of Flashpoints, and that is next on KBOO.
This Friday is International Women's Day, and KBOO will celebrate the occasion with a 35-hour extravaganza of music, interviews, and news produced and hosted by KBOO Women. We'll kick off this special day of programming on Thursday, March 7th at 7 p.m. with a live broadcast panel on the history of Portland's women's movement. And the all-women broadcast will continue until 6 a.m. on Saturday. For a full schedule, see the website kboo.fm/womensday2013.
Today on Flash. Flashpoints, thousands of Israel First citizen lobbyists descend on Capitol Hill. We'll find out why. Also, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark is in town to talk about the limits of power. And also, we'll feature excerpts from a very powerful new documentary on the battle inside Israel against occupation. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead in Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And, well, we're delighted and honored to have former Attorney General Ramsey Clark in the studio with us. Welcome to Flashpoints. We have spoken to you before, Ramsey, over the years in various parts of the globe. And you're going to be in. You're here to talk about limits of power, this power which you have spent a lifetime challenging. First, you were enforcer at the Attorney General, and then you somehow, maybe you didn't change much, but you became the people's defense. So, you know, there's a lot to talk about in terms of limits of power, but let me ask the question this way. In terms of government power and citizens' rights, compared to, say, 20 years ago, where are we? Do we have more rights? Are we safer? Are we not safer in terms of the guarantees that were supposedly given under the Constitution amendments?
Well, I'll ignore your 20-year limitation.
Okay, please do. Feel free to do
say that
you want.
I think there's been a significant erosion and government respect for fundamental human rights of our own citizens and certainly of people abroad since the idealism of the 60s. I don't think we've maintained the respect for individual rights and or human dignity that we were somehow or other inspired with. The Vietnam War took a lot of that out of us, but I think the concentration of capital has done more to hurt